The Production Expert Podcast is brought to you with the kind support of Arturia, Avid, Source Elements, and RSBE Audio Solutions.
Welcome to the Production Expert Podcast. I'm Julian Rogers, and in this week's edition, I'm joined by Ashaya and Eli Kranzberg. We're going to be discussing the commonly used term, sounds like a record. I'm sure it's a phrase we've all used. People either want it to sound like a record or they're recognising someone else's work as sounding like a record. It's a compliment. But it's not a very well-defined compliment.
It certainly is not.
Well, I mean, I'm going to kick it straight over to Ashaya. What do you think sounds like a record means?
I mean, last week we spoke to Steve DeMott, so thanks to him we have this topic of conversation. He actually questioned what sounds like a record actually means, and we thought it was a good idea to break it down. And so maybe we could break down the processes, songwriting, arrangement, recording, production, etc., and what parts of that will really make something sound like a record. I have a theory that sonically it's actually to do with production and mixing and mastering that really does the important part of this. But it should be an interesting discussion. So maybe over to Eli. What are your thoughts?
You know, it's interesting. This whole phrase sounds like a record. It's really something that we've only been using and hearing in the last 10 or 20 years. I don't think people spoke about that 30 or 40 years ago that I know of. And I think, you know, as the resident senior here, I'm going to have to assume the role of the curmudgeon and insist that it's all about the song.
I mean, interesting.
You think back to classic old recordings, and, you know, a lot of them are not flawless technically, but they're obviously great records, and it's because of the songwriting. So I think, to begin, I think the foundation we got to work from here is that the two key ingredients have to be there, and this goes across any generation or age or decade, and that's, it's got to be a great song and it's got to be a great performance. Those are two non-negotiables as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. Now, adding to that, you know, you got arrangement elements and then, of course, mixing techniques and recording techniques. But yeah, this sounds like a record to me is a relatively modern ethos to think about. And I think in modern parlance and the way it's used now, I think people are talking about things like bus compression and limiting and smiley face EQs. I think that's what's currently, you know, meant by the phrase sounds like a record. But I would bring it back to songwriting, arrangement, performance, and of course, mixing. And
yeah, I mean, I would agree to a certain extent. Do you think maybe radio ready and sounds like a record are two different concepts? Because you hear that a lot as well, sort of radio ready. I would consider radio ready to be sort of, because we do hear a lot of things on the radio that aren't necessarily incredible songs, but because of the production and the mix, they sound worthy of being played.
So some present themselves better than others because of how they translate. This we're talking about translation. I wanted to actually jump in on, before we got onto the production stuff, what Eli, what you were saying, I'd probably substitute sounds like a hit, which is kind of possibly more, but I mean, in those days when people were possibly choosing from a selection of potential songs written by professional writers for, you know, predating the whole kind of thing of the artist had to write their own material, which I know isn't a strict rule, but it's certainly something that didn't really exist before a certain date. I mean, is that really where we're going with that? I mean, the material's got to be right, sure. But I don't know if the two are interchangeable. That's what I'm saying.
It also depends how you define songwriting, because you know we think of songs as, you know, verse, chorus, bridge, lyrics, melody, harmony, chords. But nowadays, a lot of it is production oriented. But it's still, there's some interesting, compelling songwriting aspect to it. I think a lot of modern production is based around very short, repeated loops or phrases. You'll get like a two-bar, you know, especially in hip-hop, like a two-bar thing over and over again. And I'm not just talking about drums, but some riff or hick. I'm thinking Lil Nas or even Beyonce, Crazy Like You. It's like a repetitive thing, but there's a great performance on top and there's some compelling hook. And that is kind of the modern idea of what good songwriting is. And that's legitimate. I think, you know, that's legitimate. But yeah, we got to sort of broaden our definition of songwriting. It could just be, you know, compelling hooks, compelling production elements that are hookish or hooky.
Standout melodic riffs and things like that.
Yeah, just something that makes it compelling and listenable and earworm material.
I take your point that the technology has certainly kind of changed and influenced the form. So what you're talking about there is kind of it. There needs to be something there, but exactly what it is has got a little wider.
Yeah.
In the
yeah.
decades.
I mean, nowadays we call it a beat. You know, I mean, I hate that term beat, but you know.
Well,
but,
yeah, we've got hooks as well. Something just memorable, things that capture people's attention and really stand out.
Yeah,
but it's probably better than calling it an ostinato, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But yeah, I mean, so much of modern production is based around this idea of what the kids today call a beat. You know, some like 4-bar, you know, thing, and then there's like one or two variations in it throughout the piece. But with a good performance on top, usually a rap or vocal or whatever. But musically, it might just be one or two chords over a 4-bar pattern that's repeated over and over
again. I can feel us diving away from the title of the podcast. But uh-oh. I mean, well, no, it's. I'm just thinking just here that these things influence what is kind of what songs sound like, certainly, and what kind of like correct form is. Just because, I mean, I'm just thinking about the influence of sampling and about how you wouldn't have something repeated just exactly the same the whole way through a song until a sample made that the way it happened. And rather than it being kind of wrong or jarring, it became a characteristic and perfectly acceptable. I'm also thinking about things like something that I find I like so much more now my ear's kind of used to it, decades too late, admittedly. But that's sampling of chords, and when you've got stuff where you've just got the same chord, sometimes quite a sort of, you know, flavourful sort of jazzy chord possibly, but just played up and down the keyboard non-diatonically. And that I first heard that in like rave music and stuff. But you see that as a feature on synths where you've got like a chord function, so you can spread the oscillators to play a chord and you can just play it up and down the keyboard. Musically, that's wrong if you're talking traditional music theory. But what's that? It's just like we've done it for years. It sounds, it references a particular thing, so it's correct now.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of house music and dance music uses that sort of thing.
Ever wondered what it's like to mix an entire album for Kanye or layering vocals for Chris Brown? Join your hosts, Cash and G, every fortnight as we sit down with some of your favourite artists, producers and engineers to talk everything music, brought to you by Avid Pro Tools.
That sounds great.
Do you remember when we spoke with Superhigh, the songwriters and producer duo? They were saying something, and I completely agree, because they're very good songwriters, but they often send songs to A&R and different people, and they can't see through, or they can't hear through a demo that's not been really well produced, really well mixed. And so how many people can actually hear a good song without all of the, you know, good production, good mixing that is needed?
Yeah,
that
see, that's up there for me with I really enjoy hearing a big production stripped right down and somebody playing a song that I've not heard presented in that way, just on a piano or on a guitar or something, to really kind of like hear the essence of it. It's a little bit like it always gets my kind of like suspicion up if I see at a festival or something, and you see an artist come on and they've got like a ton of like choreography and kind of stuff happening and whatever, and I go, really? You know, I don't want to see all that. I just want to see some people play some music. It's slightly obfuscating to me, but that's my taste, that's all.
Yeah, I mean, I think production and mixing can cover a sort of mediocre song, but I'm just wondering whether good songs people can hear through mediocre production and a good song, you know.
You'd hope so if you're in A&R.
Yeah,
but,
you'd be surprised.
That's kind of your job, but anyway.
We're kind of veering off topic. Like, sounds like a record. We're talking about the production and the mix. It's not just the song.
Thank you for pulling us back onto topic.
You know, like, the song is the foundational element there.
Exactly.
But, yeah, it sounds like a record has to do with the production and, production and
well,
mixing.
Well, let's go back to what you were saying about production techniques and, you know, stuff that happens at the mix stage then. Go on, Ina.
Okay, well, here's some. Let me throw out some ideas here on. And I was talking to my buddy Andy Cherna about this because I wanted to get some thoughts from him, and he had some interesting ideas. You know, sounds like a record, sounds like a hit. A lot of it comes down to mix elements, like, for example, you know, when a new element comes in the arrangement, to make sure it's kind of heard at first, but then sort of gets pulled back into the mix so it fits in, you know, drawing the listener to hear something new and then have it pull back, so having to do with automation. Panning, you know, this idea of panning, if you have something hard panned or even medium panned, you know, to have something complementary on the other side so that it still sort of, even though it's hard panned, fits into the larger mix by complementing, you know, the sonically on the other side to, you know, these are all elements, I think, of a good mix that sounds like a hit or sounds like a record.
Oh, yeah.
And also, you know, and this is more modern meaning like the last 20 or 30 years, a lot, you know, volume automation and micro volume automation. I mean, just, you know, everyone's talks about having these little micro adjustments so that things hit the compressor at a relatively even volume so you can get the flavor of the compressor. I mean, that's a lot of modern sounds like a record mixing technique.
Oh, yeah. These days, especially compared to sort of 15 years ago even, we've got so much more tuning on the vocals, more saturation and compression. Obviously, yeah, we had the loudness wars as well, and things are sort of way less dynamic than they were before. And yeah, so the definition of, you know, what a record, what we hear a record sounding like is really sort of changing. I don't know if you've noticed that, you must have done, in terms of music from, I don't know, the early 2000s and now everything feels a lot more heavily compressed, tuned, saturated.
I mean, you could even go back to like the 70s. I mean, listen to old Rolling Stones or anything from the 70s. I mean, it's nowhere near as compressed as, you know, as anything in the last 30 years even.
Yeah.
True, but I mean, the thing that I'd say is characteristic of it to my ears more than the... You can tune out like dynamic range compression and stuff, but the density, something that strikes me when, yeah, I listen back a surprisingly short time is how little there is in a tune. And I find that with some really notable exceptions, because this is, you know, you can't say any single statement about music in 2023. It's too broad and there's too much of it. But something that does strike me is the amount of detail, and that's probably going back to what you were saying, Ashay, that goes into the work people are doing. Particularly, I mean, there might be something that fundamentally there's nothing there apart from, like, you know, some drums and a bass and a vocal, but right, there's so much gone into that vocal and there's loads of stuff chucking around, you know. But I mean, the point you were saying, Eli, actually, about steering the listener's attention, I totally, yeah, we've had a few conversations in the past about how similarities between good lighting design and mixing,
yeah,
where what you're doing is you're steering the attention, going, listen to this, and once you've noticed it, you don't need to shine the light quite so bright.
Exactly,
anymore.
Yeah, that's a real skill, it's a real mixing skill. It's not easy to really, you know, that takes experience.
And knowing when to remove certain things as well for other things to have more impact as,
yeah,
well.
Or pull them back. Or, yeah, yeah, or either remove them or pull them back or move them.
Exactly.
And, you know, yeah. I mean, something that I really noticed, I noticed this morning out on a walk, actually, I was listening to some stuff from the very early 80s, and entire phrases were disappearing, of the vocal were disappearing behind the track. And I was thinking that would not happen these days. You can hear, yeah, every single
Everything's
syllable.
Everything's very upfront.
You know, but, yeah, the thing is, I was thinking, does it matter? And I was thinking, I'm not sure it does.
you know, it's funny, along a similar line, I was listening to some jazz from the 50s. I can't remember if it was Ella Fitzgerald or Dinah Washington. And I was thinking, man, that sibilance, no one would allow that. Like today, that would never get released like that. And it's, of course, it sounded beautiful. It was perfect, you know, but...
Well, listening's an active process, and we choose what we hear to some extent. There was a piece I wrote earlier this year about symmetry in mixing. And, I mean, you're absolutely right about kind of like there is sort of an unspoken rule about mixes have to be balanced left to right. And I don't really see why. And in that, I kind of highlighted a few examples of records from, not all of which were old, because this is much, much more common in the early days of stereo when people were just figuring, yeah, out what to use it for. But of just kind of, you know, I'm going to have one thing on one side and nothing at all on the other. And it can be quite a cool thing to do, you know.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
for some reason, I don't do it. It's always like, oh, I need something on the other side. Why?
You're right. It's just the more modern aesthetic is to try and balance it out.
Or is it so it sounds like a record? Because nobody else does it, so I can't.
No one else does it anymore.
Yeah,
I think it's just trying to assimilate what we hear from other, you know, other records all the time. But I think a reoccurring theme is that everything seems a lot more polished than before. You know,
yeah,
things
absolutely.
Like sibilance.
And that's because we have so much software, you know, multiple, exactly, stages of compression and limiting and so on. And, you know, that wasn't available 20, 30 years ago.
We have so much control. But because you can fix something, if you hear something, You know, is there some kind of weird idea that just because you can fix something means that it necessarily has to be fixed? I mean, it's certainly something that's a potential, you know, rabbit hole to fall down.
Achoria has a wide selection of software effects, including 3 compressors, 3 filters, 3 preamps, and 3 delays you'll actually use. The latest release, 3 delays you'll actually use, includes Delay Tape 201, Delay Memory Brigade, and the unique and experimental Delay Eternity. A bundle of selected effects, called the AudioFuse Creative Suite, is included with all AudioFuse audio interfaces. Visit Achoria.com to find out more on the effects you'll actually use.
Julian, I want to ask you a question. Choose any song from the 80s that you think is a great, you know, mixed production, sounds like a record. Just choose anything.
I mean, I'd have to go for anything off So. That's probably my favorite album of the 80s.
So my question to you then is, in that production, which was obviously all hardware, you know, there was no computer back then, how many compressors do you think they used compared to, you know, a modern production where we have unlimited software compressors? How many? I wonder. In these classic productions, I can't imagine they had more than a handful of compressors, and even if they're multi-tracking, you know, so they multi-track with one compressor on each thing as it's going in. I guess my point is that the total number or stages of compressions used was probably far less than on anything anyone in their bedroom does today.
Well, I mean, see, that's an interesting one, just because I mean, So I'm pretty sure was mixed through. It would have been an E series, probably. So okay. I think, but I'm pretty sure they pulled an SSL down to kind of like the barn of Peter Gabriel's place. I know it was done, you know, on site. But so because of that, I'd imagine they probably had rather more compression to play with than, you know, previously had been the case. Because I mean, I've certainly been in that environment where you're treating channels of compression like. Like the limited resource that they are, and you don't just stick one on because you can and because why not? Because
now, I've seen lots of mixes now where people use 2-3 compressors on a track, and then that's going to a bus with another compressor, and that's going to a parallel process, then it's going to a stereo 2 bus with compression. There's just so many more stages, and I think that is a lot of what contributes to what you were saying as density. You know, the density of these modern the sound of modern records.
Certainly it could be. And I mean, these are all ways you can't compress hard enough in a single pass without it sounding a bit pumpy and, you know, so double bagging or triple bagging your compression across tracks to get more, you know, and it's all in the chasing more and more and more. And it does make you wonder, well, actually, do you necessarily need to do that? I was talking to Mike Exeter last week. And I mean, something that was coming out from the conversation was he was talking about how little compression he uses. And when you think of the genre that he is most associated with, it's just kind of like, well, you know, that's a real lesson there, you know. And it's not that he isn't controlling the dynamic range, but he's doing it using automation.
So interesting, yeah.
I mean, with things like online mastering, one thing I notice the difference between my mix and, you know, something like Lander is that everything becomes so much brighter. And so I do think we're all sort of, either it's a loudness thing or a brightness thing, but we're trying to produce and mix in a way that really captures the attention, because brighter, louder is always going to capture the listener's attention more than something darker.
This is a good question in that case, both of you. Have you ever noticed a commercial mix being, I'm going to guess the answer is yes, but I need to ask whether you have, noticed a commercial mix being too bright for your taste? If so, do you remember what it was?
I can't think of one offhand, but...
I mean, I honestly, I tend to, at this point in my career, try to chase what commercial records are doing in terms of mix standards. So I would just sort of adapt my mix to match that level, whether I think it's, you know, too loud or not.
Because it's an eye-opener when you're A-Bing, isn't it?
Yes, mean, it really is.
I know that the first time I got hold of like a plug-in where I could just seamlessly A-B, and I was astonished at how bright everything was.
I can remember
very clearly the first CD I ever bought that I thought this is so bright it's fatiguing for me was Brother Sister by the Brand New Heavies. So that was would have been 90s. I don't know exactly the year, but that would have been sort of like the sort of acid jazz 90s thing. And it was a good record, but it was so bright.
And how bright is it comparison
to... Oh, it's positively muffled by today's standards, I'd imagine. Oh, wow. But the one that I remember hearing that was just like too limited for me to listen to was The Killers' Hot Fuzz. I can't listen to it now. It's just a racket to me, just because of what they did to it. So, you know.
You know, one tool I find really useful for not just brightness, but brightness specifically, is a tonal balance from Isotope. You know, I always slap that on at the end of my processing. And off, you know, the meter only goes up to about 12.5. And, you know, after that, there's no more, you know, the scale ends, but you can see the line going up. And I'm always way up, you know, up like around 15, 16, 17. Even though it's hard to hear up there, I can see that I got lots of activity up there. But I find that keeps me honest in terms of what's happening in the high end.
Mm. Have you ever used that, Asha?
No, I haven't, actually.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
I have used it. It is a cool thing, I have to say. Yeah. It's not something that I'd let make decisions for me, but I know that, I mean, left to my own devices, I mix stuff way darker than, you know, sound. So yeah. I do feel that kind of implied pressure to kind of like, crank it, you know.
Yeah, really.
You know what I often find with tonal balance is I slap it on at the end, and if I see some deficit somewhere in the frequency range, I'll put like an EQ before it on the two bus and make a little adjustment. And 9 times out of 10, it helps. It points me in the right direction. I might not do it as much as would be indicated by the tonal balance level in that area, but I will make an adjustment based on what I see. And as I say, most of the time, it's a positive.
This reminds me of because it's this business of A-Bing, which sounds like a good idea, but when we're A-Bing, we do so, you know, quickly. The whole point is listen to that, listen to the other, and these short term things aren't necessarily the best way to make those decisions.
No.
It's a little bit like if you buy some kind of packaged, prepackaged food compared to cooking at home. Here I am with the food analogy, but it's, you know, so if you're buying like a ready meal or something, it'll have way too much salt in it. If it's something that takes sugar, it'll be way sweeter than I do it myself. That's because they get focus groups together and go, which one do you prefer? And they have one spoonful. And guess what? The sugar and the salt win.
Yeah.
But in the same way, if I'm listening and I'm going bright versus less bright, of course I'm going to go, hey, yeah, it sounds loads better brighter. But we know that, and that's not the way to make necessarily those, you know. Anyway, there's more to it than just dipping in and out.
I suppose it goes back to that sort of attention span thing that we spoke about, I think it was last week as well, in terms of you only get sort of, I don't know, 20, 30 seconds to impress people before they skip, right? And so if you're sort of duller and quieter than the next record, often people will just skip because it doesn't stand out.
Sort of songwriting. You know, the old trope, don't bore us, get to the chorus.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Never mind separating it out into songwriting and arrangement and mix and all of that stuff. The thing that I keep coming back to more and more, actually, in sort of conversations I'm having is when stuff sounds correct, it sounds, as I'd put it, like a record, meaning that it sounds like a song that I've heard before, but it isn't a song that I've, or a record I've heard before, but isn't the same as. Do you see what I mean? It's like
that's a very good point.
It shares common ground with enough to, for it not to kind of, you know, confuse me, shall we say, but without it sounding like it's in any way sort of slavishly copying something. Songs you haven't heard before can sound familiar without sounding predictable. And that's the sweet spot.
Yeah.
Whereas if they're a little bit out there, then they can sound, they can be a little bit, what am I listening to? I had a really interesting record the other day when I was, I went to Sensound, which is this, I wrote an article about it. It was an Atmos studio in Worcestershire. And it was great over there. And I just spent kind of an afternoon sitting around with a couple of nice people listening to just some commercial Atmos mixes. And there was one tune in particular that I thought was really interesting. I'm just looking at what is Concrete Over Water by a band called Jockstrap. And it was interesting just because it was all over the place in terms of kind of arrangement and songwriting. It was very unfamiliar stuff. It did not sound like a record, if you sort of mean a convention hugging exercise in conformity. You know what I mean? It was there's some really interesting things in there. But what I really liked about it was the fact that it was an Atmos mix that that hadn't been kind of like bolted on afterwards. The songwriting, it was clear they'd been thinking, or it seemed to me at least, that like they'd been thinking about how to present stuff in an immersive sound field. And they'd got all sorts of really nice little bits in there that didn't sound tacked on, didn't sound like, hey, I know what we could do. We could just spread that out and move it to the back. You know, none of that. Very interesting indeed. But the reason I mention that isn't about the Atmos element. It's the fact that it was a record that I heard that I liked, that was unfamiliar and did kind of confront my expectations without going to the point of losing me, you know what I mean? Because you've got to keep the listener with you, or else what are you trying to achieve?
So you're saying, basically, Julian, that we need a some sort of predictability and familiarity within these productions.
But it still needs to engage in surprise.
Exactly. Yeah. David Guetta does this to the extreme, sort of redoing those 90s old house tracks and rearranging with different vocalists, different lyrics. But they're obviously classic house tracks from the 90s. And people, obviously, they're familiar with the melody and the sounds of those things. And it's, you know, things like the elements, production elements. You could use an organ from a sort of really well-known house track, and that is a familiarity aspect as well.
You've absolutely nods to particular genres, totally. So kind of like, you know, got an organ bass if you want to immediate offbeat. And it's like, okay, all right, I know where we are now. So things like that. There's also, I mean, another way to make something sound like a record is basically to nick a bit of a record people know and stick it in your track. That brings us back to the sampling thing. But you know what I mean? It's like if it works kind of like legally, then you know it's a great way to do it. Just because, you know, I mean, it's not necessarily a cheap trick that people do to piggyback on other people's fame. You know, when Madonna used the ABBA sample, you know what I mean? It's not because she was going, hey, you know, I can leverage some of ABBA's fame. It's like, I think we're kind of a conversation between equals there in terms of in terms of fame. But it was a smart move in terms of being able to exploit a reference.
Yeah, and I think if you've got a good label involved, then that's great, because you can get permission for the samples and stuff like that. And a lot of producers do that. I think it's a lot harder if you're, you know, less well known to.
It's
to
asymmetrical.
Sort of
it's like, why would they? What's in it for me apart from, you know, you can I'll give you some of the money that my record that's not going to sell is going to me. You know, it's like,
yeah, exactly.
The Production Expert Podcast is made possible using Source Connect Now from Source Elements, the free way to record high quality audio over the internet. Need to record an interview or a podcast like this one remotely? With Source Connect Now, you can. Using a Chrome browser, you'll get ISDN equivalent quality audio without the need to install any additional software. Register for your free account at now.source-elements.com.
Okay, just to pull back to the sounds like a record thing, let's try and suggest a different angle to look at it. What are the things that prevent productions or mixes from sounding like a record? And I have something in my, an answer in mind, but, you know, what are the obstacles that prevent things from sounding like a record? And I would say a lot of it comes down to arrangement and over-arrangement. You know, it's so easy in our modern DAW-based environments to over-arrange.
Oh, yeah.
And I find a lot of what I hear from a lot of people when people send me mixes to listen to, I often hear the most common problem is just too much happening. It's too many different parts, too many things happening. You know, strip down some of the parts and it'll sound more like a record, where you can focus on the song and the individual elements come through and, it, you know, the listener's ear is able to focus on what's going on.
Yeah, it's about knowing which elements need to be there and which don't, you know.
Your track should grow horizontally along the timeline, not vertically down it. And there's something I used to, when I used to teach, there was an acronym that I've used a few times, which is TMSGO, which is the short for too much shit going on. It's just like, look, seriously, what are you doing? You know, and it's kind of like, okay, so you've got a 4-bar loop. Just making it 32 tracks deep isn't making it more.
Yeah.
Do you think that's because they don't have a good idea to begin with, right? There's something that they feel there's something missing, so they're constantly adding more and more
things. I totally understand. It's because it's so easy to do.
Yeah, you know, there's so much, like with arpeggiators and multi-stage envelope modulation, there's so many interesting...
I feel seen.
You know, to generate these interesting rhythms that all grab the attention and they're all great, but too many of them and it becomes meaningless.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm. Yeah,
because you're not directing the listener's attention. I mean, it's that thing that you said, Eli, about, you know, what is it you want me to hear?
Yeah. Julian, I wanted to ask you earlier, you know, you were talking about A-B-ing mixes in terms of sounds like a record. What do you think of this strategy that a lot of people use of when they're A-B-ing, soloing out the specific frequency ranges? So they'll listen to, let's say, below 200 hertz and A-B that with, you know, their hit record and their mix. And then they'll solo out, you know, 200 to 1K and focus on that. And, you know, like a very kind of microscopic, you know, rather than holistic, you know, very clinical look at this idea of A-B-ing and trying to match.
I've not heard of that.
Oh, okay.
What I have heard of is people auditioning bands just to have a look at what's going on in recordings that they admire. And I don't think it's particularly useful. It's not going to tell you a whole lot, but why not? It does no harm. The thing, I mean, I've got a more fundamental issue with A-B-ing because it's such pervasive advice of like everyone should A-B. And I'm not going to say people shouldn't A-B, but there's a definite limit on what you can achieve with it. Just because what I find if I'm A-B-ing stuff is that I'm listening to one piece of music and I'm listening to an entirely different piece of music. And there is a real limit on the similarities and conclusions you can draw between the two things. And I mean, if you're just talking about, you know, how bright is it? Yeah, sure. You know, yeah, you can do that and it may or may not, but the you know, if the source material within each recording is different, then there will be different amounts of energy at different points in the frequency, you know. So if you're doing something where somebody's just hammering a crash ride the whole way through and your piece is played on close hats, you can't really draw a like-for-like comparison between, you know, it's like...
I mean, yeah, it's important to get the right references, right? But if you do have a reference that's similar and you're comparing, you know, the chorus of one and your chorus, I think it can be quite good to sort of understand the energy. You know, because it's quite easy to lose perspective when you're in something. You can turn it up and you think, oh yeah, this is really impactful. And it's only when you compare it to the reference that you think, oh wow, okay, maybe I need the drums, I need more punch there, it needs to be brighter. I find that a lot when I'm A-B-ing, to be honest.
I mean, it's something that I'm very much of the opinion of is kind of like perspective is the most valuable resource that you've got, which is why everything about mixing as quickly as possible and just getting through it as quickly as you can with your perspective intact. But what I find is that kind of like the longer a mix goes on, it doesn't get better. Yeah.
And I agree with you, Julian. I think A-B-ing is not the panacea that everyone makes it out to be. It's useful, but only up to a point.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but I'm saying it's not the secret answer to suddenly making your mixes great, because it's, you know, it's just listening to something else at this concurrently.
Mm, absolutely.
But yeah. Metric AB is still awesome.
RSPE Audio Solutions design, sell, and install professional audio and video equipment. Their team are available by phone, live chat, or email to receive and process orders. They have everything you need to build or upgrade your home studio to ensure you can continue to work from home. If there is anything they can do to help, reach out or shop online at rspeaudio.com.
Well, I think we should stop right there because we've got Eli and Ashaya on a podcast, and it would be remiss of us not to talk about logic-related things with the font of all logic wisdom that is Eli. So, I'm going straight into stuff that I know very little about, but there's been like some updates or something, has there?
You know, to pull it into the topic we're talking about in this podcast, the flagship update in Logic 10.8 is the mastering assistant, you know, so it's kind of got its own built-in little mini, you know, ozone type of function. And in terms of sounding like a record, it's to help, you know, everyone in their bedroom get closer to sounding like a record. So yeah, that is the flagship new feature, this built-in mastering assistant, which I think is a very positive thing. It's great. It works really well. I mean, it's not like the big boys, you know, like Ozone. I mean, it doesn't offer the degree of control, but with the limited, you know, range of what is adjustable in it, which is very useful. It's kind of a do no harm range, you know.
We ran a test on it on the site, so if anyone wants to hear it, check that out. My main takeaway was that it was pretty sort of restrained.
Yeah,
it wasn't.
Yeah, which I think is a very positive thing. Yeah, it's keeping people away from the loudness wars things. It's not crank it up and get a ton of limiting. You're right. It's to keep it in a good healthy range. So I think it's a very positive thing. What do you think about it, Ashaya?
I think it's brilliant because it allows you to sort of make changes to your mix as well, and then go back to it. For example, it analyzes it based on commercial recordings, which is quite cool, what we were saying about the A-Bing before. But you can then go in and tweak the settings. And then if you're finding yourself doing too much in the mastering stage, you can go back to your mix and make adjustments, which is really, really handy in terms of sort of modern day music making and stuff like that. And I think it's fantastic. Yeah. And they have a loudness compensation button as well, which is really good. Yeah.
It reminds me a bit of Master Desk, that plugin from Plugin Alliance, where it again, everything was like in a do no harm range. You know, it only goes like plus or minus 3B, 3 dB. You know, the whole throw of the knobs on there. It's kind of like that, like these EQ curves in Mastering Assistant. It's only a few dB that it'll allow you to go up or down. Which, if you need more than that, that's not the place to be doing it.
Mm. Yeah, but I think it's fantastic because, you know, it saves you bouncing out your mix, going and mastering and then realizing you need to make changes. It's just a sort of time saver thing as well. And it sounds really nice and clean, and you've got different modes as well, right? Yeah. You've got the character, so you can have transparent valve as well. So it's very much like the Lander. Have you tried the Lander mastering plugin? No, but I think it's really a great addition for
Logic.
What
I'm hoping we'll see, and maybe Logic 11, whenever that happens, is Bus Assistant. That'd be interesting.
Ooh.
Explain.
Well, you know, what Mastering Assistant does, let's say we have that for buses, you know, Drum Bus Assistant, Guitar Bus Assistant, Vocal Bus Assistant. That could be interesting.
That could be very interesting. Indeed. Another thing I really, really like is the Beat Breaker. No, it wasn't the Beat Breaker, sorry. It was the new sampler.
Yeah, Sample Alchemy.
Sample Alchemy. Yeah, yeah, that is really, really cool. It kind of reminds me of the Waves CR8 sampler, which I use quite a lot. And the GUI is just really, really sort of intuitive and straightforward. And
I agree. What I like about it is it's got just the right amount of complexity. Like, it's not so much to be overwhelmed with, but you know, you can get quick results just turning a few knobs, but you can dig in deeper and get into the different synthesis modes and, you know, modulate them. It's I find the interface very well done in that. And I think, you know, I would describe Sample Alchemy as kind of what Quick Sampler is to sampling, Sample Alchemy is to synthesis. But the idea of, you know, drag and drop a sample in and you can apply granular, additive, spectral with a couple of intuitive knobs and modulate them easily, I find the whole thing very inviting, you know, and user-friendly.
Yeah, really great for inspiration as well. And you've got the four different parts as well, which are labeled ABCD.
Very interesting.
Which is very cool. Yeah.
I did I did some videos on it, and I did a thing where I took a, you know, phrase of a live guitar player I had here, and I took one note, just one single note, and was able to turn it into a pad, like a nice pad with movement and textures. So it's very cool for stuff like that. And I'm also a big fan of Beat Breaker. You know, again, whenever you have these things built into the DAWs, they're not as great as the standalone third-party options that are available. But nonetheless, there's something to be said for the convenience. They're right there. They do what they do easily and intuitively. And I think Beat Breaker is a lot of fun.
Explain to us what it does, because it's basically like Stutter Edit, right?
It's like Stutter Edit, but easier, built in, and again, like the right amount of complexity. You can do something like take a vocal phrase, a two-bar phrase, and chop it. You know, it's automatically slicing it and chopping it and repeating it. And when I say automatically, obviously you have control over what it's going to do, but you can very quickly create really interesting vocal chops with that in a very interesting way that like would be, for me personally, I wouldn't think of, like, in terms of manual editing, I wouldn't think to do those things. But when I do, adjust a couple of knobs on Beat Breaker, I go, wow, that's really cool. I want to use that. And I just wouldn't think of coming up with that type of edit on my own. So I find it really great for that. Of course, you can use it on drums and everything, but just the idea of taking a performance and chopping it up and splicing and getting a vocal chop type of result, you know, I find it very intuitive and fun and stimulating. I find it creatively stimulating.
Yeah, absolutely. It gives you so many ideas, and it's so fast as well. It's really cool. And I think Logic have done really well to add these new, I think they're some of the best updates that we've had in a while.
Yeah.
What would you say?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, the whole 10.7, lineage, whatever, was really all about the Dolby Atmos thing, which, you know, isn't of general interest to maybe many people. I'm going to go on a limb and say that. So 10.7 was really focused on the Atmos stuff. So, yeah, it's nice to get some get back to sort of new music features, music making features.
Absolutely. And with the drummer thing as well, as it's a smaller thing, but it's actually quite handy where you can just sort of move the region into a software instrument track without sort of converting it.
Absolutely. This whole democratization, you know, of track types and, you know, drummer regions, patterns, MIDI, and it's all kind of freely interchangeable. It's very liberating. And I think, you know, a lot of people will come up with creative uses for it.
Mm. And I have to say, Eli, you explained these concepts really well in your course as well.
Oh, thank you.
So, thank you for that. I imagine, Julian, you really don't know what we're talking about.
I know, but, you know, hands up, I'm not a Logic user. I just, you know.
It's okay.
But,
you
know. I'm aware of the mastering assistant. And, you know, I mean, it always strikes me as interesting when stuff like that, which has only existed as a third-party option, gets brought in-house by someone like Apple. And and that's, you know, that's quite a big thing to happen, certainly to that kind of like... It takes quite a lot of potential customers out of the equation, if you see what I mean, if you provide something within the DAW. So that's an interesting thing to do. And the natural response is for the third-party offerings to get better. So
yeah,
that might be good, you know? It puts some pressure
absolutely.
On.
There's a large demographic of Logic users who really, they want to just stick with the Logic plugins. They just do their stuff with Logic. So, yeah, it's a great addition in that sense.
And I'm just glad that they haven't done the make it, you know, toothpaste the mix and push the sides out so wide they meet behind you, you know, because they could easily have gone down that route. And I'm glad to see they've, you know, exercised some taste and restraint, you know.
They even included, you know, there's a like a widening, you know, stereo width feature, and they have a nice correlation meter there so you can see,
yes.
You know, they really thought it through nicely.
We should, I mean, thank you for that, but time is moving on, so we should move to Find of the Week.
Okay. Absolutely. Eli, what is your Find of the Week?
My Find of the Week, you know, I it's so cliche, but a really good plugin that I found that I like. But it's a channel strip plugin by this company called Vustek, and it's a Neve channel strip. And, nice. You know, I'm a sucker for a really beautiful GUI, and it sounds fantastic. I just think it's only $20. It's a lot of fun.
I checked it out, and that is a photorealistic GUI.
It really is, isn't it? It's amazing.
Yeah. It's like, yeah.
And
yeah.
it sounds fantastic. A couple of things I really like about it, it's got, you know, the drive section, but it's gain compensated. And I love that it's got a wide range of throw until you actually hear audible, you know, distortion. So you can really get that density that we like. There's a good amount there that you can do, and there's different models to choose from. And there's two compressor models. They both sound different. One sounds to me a bit more like kind of like an SSL bus compression kind of thing, and the other one's just more characterful for individual instruments. And it's got the different modes of EQ. And one thing I've always hated on Neve, maybe it makes sense in hardware, but on software Neve emulations, I've always hated those concentric rings where, you know, you have to one color the knob is for frequency and the same knob.
Yeah, dual concentric pots are a bit awkward.
Yeah, I hate
aren't they?
That. Yeah. You know, so this has the separate virtual pots for frequency and for gain, and it just sounds good. It's fun. It's intuitive. The gain compensation. It's just a pleasure to use.
And as an emulation, how does it stand up to the real deal?
I mean, I don't know anything about real Neves. I'm unashamedly stating, and I don't even care, you know. I mean, I just know I like the way this sounds, and sounds good.
Yeah, nice. Well, that's the most important.
I've always been my mindset's always been, it's like, I don't care how closely it models the original hardware. Mm. I just care if it sounds good, if I like it, and if it works for me.
Completely.
It does make me think that, looking at the GUI in that you know, like kind of sort of Fender and people do relicked guitars, so they're kind of pre-bashed up and look like that.
Yeah.
Well, this is a relicked plugin. I mean,
yeah, you know, it's got a knob there on the right. You'll see for age, like to, you know, old
oh,
to new.
Really? Oh, really?
Yeah, and as you dial it up, the GUI gets a bit more scratched up. it's kind of fun.
Yeah, it does look really, really
like
cool.
Like it. Well, you know, that's cool.
Yeah, Julian.
Oh, mine. Okay, right. So mine is this Sonos Era 300, which is it's this very cool, like single unit, standalone Atmos smart speaker, for want of a better word. You know,
nice.
It's one of those Sonos speakers. But I heard it when I was at this place last week, and I was gobsmacked how good it was. I mean, because I've been very sort of like, yeah, you know, it's all very well, you know, but. Just being comparing it to playback across a good, properly set up Atmos system, and I tell you what, It was all right. But the thing that really surprised me about it was that it was in a properly treated studio with, you know, which is pretty dead. And things like that rely on throwing sound off the walls. And I would have thought that putting it in a dry, treated acoustic like that would kill its effectiveness. But it still worked. It was all right. And yeah, no issues with that at all. It kind of makes me wish that my current smart speakers in my kitchen weren't as kind of like nice as they are, just because I'm not really reluctant to swap them out. But if I was starting again, I would look at that. £450, great, great device.
So an easy way to consume spatial audio then?
Very much so. Very much so, and very kind of like domestic friendly. There's no power tools required.
I mean, it doesn't look like it would sound as good as it apparently sounds.
Yeah,
well, go small compact, right?
Pop to like John Lewis or somewhere and check it out, because seriously, it's I was astonished how good it was.
Yeah.
So yes. Fantastic. What about you, Anna? What's yours to share?
Yes, mine's actually a play. It's Agatha Christie's A Witness for the Prosecution, but with a slight twist, because it's actually inside a courtroom at the London County Hall, which I thought sounded really cool. It's directed by someone called Lucy Bailey. You can basically, they offer VIP jury seats as well, so you can actually feel like you're part of the jury.
What a cool idea.
Yeah.
Having it in a courtroom.
I mean, we're talking about immersive audio, but this is like immersive theatre. I've always loved the idea of, you know, being involved in the production, involved in the play. I think it's really consuming and exciting. So, and I like Agatha Christie as well. So, yeah.
Do you know who did it?
I don't. I haven't seen this one.
No
actually.
Spoilers.
I haven't read
okay.
this one. No, so there's no spoilers, but I think I'll definitely go to that. It's just really cool. It's very exciting. I love London theatre in general, but this is very
great
different.
Stuff. Yeah. Well, that sounds fantastic. That's all we've got time for this week. Thank you to Ashaya. Thank you to Eli. We'll be back next week with another edition of the Production Expert Podcast.